Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to This is the Place, a podcast series from The Common magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. Today, we'll be talking to Casey Walker about his story, Vigilancia, which appears in issue 20 of The Common. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Casey Walker is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and has a PhD in English literature from Princeton University. He is the author of the novel Last Days in Shanghai. His writing has appeared in The Believer, Boston Review, and the Los Angeles Review of Books. He is currently finishing a new novel, Mexicali, exploring the history of the Mexican-American borderlands where he was born and raised. Casey Walker, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Emily. It's great.
Would you set the scene for this conversation? Tell us where you're calling from, where you're living?
Yeah. So currently I'm in Portland, Oregon, which is digging its way out of a big snowstorm and ice storm that we had last week. So I think power now has been restored to almost everyone in the city. And that's usually, we're usually good for about one big snowstorm a year, but this one was kind of a major freak out. We had, I think, something like half the city had lost power at one point. Usually it's a very nice place to live.
It sounds good. And I'm glad you have power and you dug out.
Yeah.
Would you start us off with a reading from your story, maybe the first few paragraphs?
Absolutely. So the story is called Vigilancia. The secret police, people said, but this was a label M never understood. Everyone knows we exist, he thought. And of course, we are not secret to ourselves. From whom is this secret kept? Couples filled the Café Suiza, no longer the solitary man of before the war. From the rack of newspapers, they never chose the copies of Un Século. They spoke anything but Portuguese, French and English, German, Slavic languages he could barely identify. M observed their necklaces, their rings. Some were Jews of the merchant classes, shaken from the rest of Europe, men wearing one last suit of shabby clothes and bartering away the family jewelry. Other patrons were no doubt spies for the Allied or Axis agencies. There was a painter at a nearby table, his canvases at his feet, rolled up and tied with twine. He drank tea with his dowager patron, who still wore her better dresses. The world had come to Lisbon, M thought, something that had not been true for 400 years. It was a chambermaid M was waiting on, from the Hotel Frankfurt. Among the rooms the maid serviced, there lived an old French couple registered under a false surname. The German security services had requested the PVDE make immediate delivery of that pair. The Reich believed the couple were financiers of the French resistance who'd slipped through Bordeaux with forged papers.
Thanks for reading that. For our listeners who may not have read your story yet, would you just describe briefly what the piece is about?
Yeah, so the story takes place in kind of World War II era Portugal. And just the kind of basic kind of geopolitical history that that rests on. I mean, Portugal was neutral in World War II, and it kind of acted as this very strange kind of hinge point between Allied and Axis powers. That it was a very fraught sort of neutrality. And you got the sense that the Portuguese dictator at the time, Salazar, was sort of trying his best to sort of play both sides of this, and being wooed in various ways by both sides. So Lisbon at this time is a neutral city, while this war is ravaging Europe, and it becomes this place that's full of refugees and spies and military intelligence, and there's obviously this kind of the secret police of the Portuguese dictatorship, and in a way, it becomes this very interesting milieu in that sense. I mean, if you've seen the movie Casablanca, there's a kind of famous plot point in Casablanca about trying to get transit papers to get to and out of Lisbon. So it was a place of embarkation for a lot of people trying to get out of war-torn Europe. So there was just like this immense kind of subterfuge that's happening, and that's the kind of the background for the story.
That's great. And would you describe a little bit about M, just so people know who we're talking about?
Right. So M, the figure who's the kind of central figure of the story, is he's more or less an informant for the Portuguese secret police, which at the time was called the PVDE, and later becomes the PDE, is what you often hear them called. But he's more or less one of this endless kind of series of informal kind of informant figures who's selling information to various higher ups in this agency, and in a way just trying to like carve out his own particular living in this place of subterfuge and espionage.
Yes, yeah, and he's using the chambermaid as sort of another informant, if he can get her to
right. I mean,
to be informant.
This is essentially how he makes his living, is kind of collecting this information from people and seeing what's usable. I mean, sort of like a scrap merchant in that way, sort of seeing what's usable to sell and what he can sell back. And it involves him in this way, encountering this chambermaid who he believes has information about this couple staying in the hotel. And then you learn after the section that I just read, I mean, within the first page or so, the kind of, you know, instigating point here for him is that he figures out that he recognizes this chambermaid from his childhood, that she's somebody who grew up in a nearby village, and he hasn't seen her in decades, but he's certain that it's her. So it sort of complicates this, it complicates his ability to get information out of her, because he now is contending with this kind of history of his memories of her as well.
That's great. Would you, I mean, I think it's probably fair to say this piece is not autobiographical. So could you tell us just like how you came to write it? Like, was there a specific inspiration or something that brought you to this sort of time and place?
Yeah, it's true. I do have to admit up front that I never was an agent for the secret police in Portugal in World War II. You know, I think the what it grew out of was, you know, quite simply just Lisbon itself. So my mom's side of the family is Portuguese. They've been in the United States a long time, but that side of the family, there's still a fairly big kind of contingent of Portuguese in the kind of Sacramento area. And I grew up visiting them and seeing that. I first went to Portugal 2010, and I was with my mom, and we kind of went on this search for some long lost relatives. And that was the first time I had seen Lisbon. I went back in 2016 as part of the Disquiet conference on a fellowship that they have specifically for people of kind of Luso descent. And it was just being there in 2016 and being able to be there for an extended period of time and meet all of these Portuguese writers and just be in Lisbon in what felt to me like a very deep and privileged way, that I had started thinking about this story. And I mean, I tend to do a lot of reading about places that I'm going to travel to and places that I'm going to visit. So in the run-up to going back to Lisbon, I had read histories of Lisbon, and I was reading novels set in Lisbon. And, you know, it's hard to say exactly. It's been several years now what exactly the kind of the first inciting moment for this story was. But reading about that, Portugal's very complicated neutrality in World War II made me think that there was really something. There was really something there, because you had so many people in such deep states of conflicted loyalty, that it seemed to me that there had to be just a lot of narrative possibility there.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much sort of innate conflict in that kind of setting and in that time.
Yeah.
I also think there's just something so nice about, you know, I'm writing about World War II as well. Mm-hmm. And I know, like, it is such an overtold story in some ways, yeah, that we all know so much about it, yeah, that whenever you hit on these aspects of it that are sort of lesser known, I think that's always just like really fascinating, because you don't have to tell, the reader a whole lot, because they instantly know the context. You know, you say allies, you say Axis.
Right.
You say the Reich, like people know immediately what you're talking about and all the emotional conflict that comes with that. And so you can just play in that space and you don't have to sort of create it yourself, I think.
I think that's totally right. I mean, people at least have that thumbnail sketch, and you don't have to do a lot of kind of furniture moving, especially in a short story. You don't have to waste a lot of expository energy explaining who I don't need to tell people who the Reich are or who the French Resistance are, for the most part. And coming at it, I think through, I would be daunted, I think, to write about World War II in its larger aspects, coming at it from this very small aperture of just the Portuguese, mm-hmm, role, and just like what it looked like in Lisbon at this particular moment, to me felt like, well, I can certainly look at it through this particular keyhole.
Yeah, absolutely. Would you tell us how you went about writing the city, like, you know, 75, 80 years in the past? Did you have to do a lot of research?
I did. I mean, I did do a fair amount of research, and there's a book that's specifically about this time by the writer is Neil Lockery. I think it's just called Lisbon. And it has something to do, you know, it says, you know, Lisbon 1940 to 1945, kind of the war years. That was something I had read before I went to Lisbon. And then while I was there, I was, of course, reading Pessoa, as everyone does. there's this Italian writer, Antonio Tabucchi, who lived in Portugal for most of his adult life and ended up writing in Portuguese. He wrote wonderful novels about Lisbon. One of them called Requiem, and another one called Pereira Maintains. And Pereira Maintains takes place around the same time. So there was a fair amount of reading that I was doing just around the period. But, you know, there was so much of it too that, you know, at least at the time being, Lisbon is in a state right now of extended development, really, where a lot of old buildings are coming down and a lot of new things are going up. And it's really been discovered as part of a tourist itinerary in the way that it hadn't been even 10 years ago. I mean, it's a different city from when I went in 2010. But still, it still remains that there's still a lot of places that I write about in this story that are still there. I mean, the stories are still there in those buildings and stones. And up until a couple of years ago, the Café Suíça was still there, the Hotel Frankfurt, you know, Rocio Square, the castle, a lot of these kind of big central aspects of the city. I mean, the cobblestones are still the same cobblestones. so some of that, actually, I could walk around Lisbon and feel like I was still in the same space, essentially, that I was writing about in the piece.
It's interesting to hear that, you know, the sort of combination of research and sort of real lived experience. Mm-hmm. I taught a class a year or two, a short class about how to write like really rich settings. Mm. And the thing that I sort of lean towards is making settings feel really lived in, like there's sort of like life going on behind the scenes, like apart from your main characters, and that life kind of continues on after the scene ends. And I think you do this so beautifully in Vigilancia because this, it's a whole city, and you really manage to kind of get across all of the sort of like the grime and, you know, the people who work there. I'm thinking about how in just the part you read where, you know, you can see the whole lives of these other people who are sitting at the cafe with him. And then later when it's time to go, he, you know, we see them inside the cafe, they're putting the chairs up, and then a woman is, you know, dumping out filthy water behind the hotel, like this sort of like real lived in city.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like writers, writing about places abroad, it can be sort of like a film set. It can be a little flat. Right. And so I wonder just like, how, do you know how you pulled that off? Like, how did you make it so multidimensional and sort of avoid the pitfalls of writing a foreign city?
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, it's wonderful to hear that comes across. I mean, it's sort of exactly the note that I'm hoping to strike, is to make it feel like a lived in place. I mean, I suppose I can lay some cards on the table here and say that. I mean, I wrote an entire dissertation that was about place, essentially, that was about the novel and the city, and the development of the modernist novel against the backdrop of urbanization. I mean, this is a subject that's fascinated me for a long time. And I read pretty deeply that were just novels about places. And I think one of the things that I took away from all of that reading was this idea that a place is not an inert or neutral sort of backdrop, that it's not a scene, that it's like they actually have these living histories, and also the way that they can kind of condition the kinds of lives that take place there. I mean, I'm really interested in the possibilities of cities and in city design and city construction. And you know, there's just little bits and stuff in that story where you think about like the kind of wandering old pathways of the Alfama district in Lisbon and these kind of old medieval corridors, and how that and the contrast between that. You know, that's where the chambermaid in the story lives, in this this older, dense section of the city where the streets are very narrow and there's all these little alleyways, and it's very easy if you're not a native to get lost there. But it's also they're very intimate quarters of Lisbon. I mean, the places where neighbors are so close side by side, where you can almost reach across balconies that are across the street, where everybody knows your business, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so to have her live there and to have her be so surveilled just by her social world, you know, that's an important element. I mean, it's not something that's commented on directly in the story. It's an important element of the story, whereas some of the newer sections of Lisbon, and I say newer in the sense of like post-earthquake, so like newer might be, you know, still 250 years old, right, where they have the more in the Baixa and the downtown, and where Rocio Square is, you know, it's a straight grid of streets. It's fairly regular. It's fairly open. That's where these big old cafes and stuff are. This is the place where you would go and meet people and be seen. And, you know, I thought a lot about where certain scenes in the story would take place, and that there should be this kind of conversation happening between the place and the characters, and between the narrative of what's going on in the story and this and the place where it's set. I mean, I think of that really as the kind of grounding of a lot of what I'm doing, so that the place is every bit as important to me as the central character. I mean, it's that Lisbon and this character M are kind of imbricated together. I mean, they're this inseparable thing. So I think for me, and part of it, how you not make it like a film set is it's inconceivable to me to think of it as a as a film set. Like I want it to feel as much a part of the conversation of the story as the characters do.
I guess it's no surprise that it was such a good fit for our magazine. You know, with our focus on place.
It's why I sent it, for sure.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you did. I was going to ask you, you and I worked together on some revisions to this story before publication, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that you revised it a lot on your own, even mm-hmm. before you did submit it to us. Would you talk a little about that process and like how different the final version is from where you started?
Yeah, absolutely. So I got back from Lisbon in 2016, and really just out of the kind of flurry of all that experience. I mean, you've been to Disquiet yourself, so you know what that 2 weeks is like. and you're just, it is just morning until late in the night, where it's just full of readings and conversation and the city itself and meeting points and miradores. And I came back from that. And of course, I mean, I just missed it terribly. You're just like, well, this is what life should be like all the time. I mean, I also needed to sleep for like a week, but, yeah. but then after that, I sat down and I wrote the first draft of this story in probably about 6 weeks. I mean, and just out of a haze of trying to recover and preserve some of what I felt like I had experienced there. And then over the course of, several years, I mean, I tend to write stories in, the first draft of a story in a couple months and then put it away for a while. And I find that then coming back to it, even, you know, 6 months, a year later, it's like, it's like had this opportunity to sort of age. And I've lost some of my initial, kind of preciousness about certain things or moments, and you can kind of see what the fit, but, I think over the course of the years, what ended up happening was, I mean, I'm a pretty big believer in the big kind of maximalist draft, where you try to fit every part in and you try to see, you try to write through every little tributary that the story offers you. Because I think you come upon some interesting discoveries that way and things that kind of elude whatever your initial plan was. And then the latest last drafts, the last couple of drafts, are just absolute hacking away at the maximalism. So the last couple are just a minimal thing. So by the time it got to you and the stuff that you and I were working on, I mean, I think the biggest change would be it just got shorter. I mean, I think almost everything I've ever published has been about half as long as my kind of original draft. And I think this story is about that way too. I think it just got cut, not quite in half, but very close. But I think to me, I mean, that's just like as you just take away and take away and take away and you just see what is absolutely essential to the functioning of the story. Then I think you really do start to realize that you don't, that there's a lot of things that you're convinced that you need and that the reader is going to need that they really don't. I mean, they'll come along on the journey with you with actually very little backstory and exposition, if they're interested in whatever the kind of deeper conflicts are.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we recommended a few cuts and that you came back to us with a version that was even more cut than we had recommended. And it was wonderful. It was great.
Right. That is, it's like the final process is really just finding out what can go. I mean, I allow myself a lot of leeway for a very long time. And then it's like, then it gets very serious about what needs to go. So yes, when you say, you know, cut 1,000 words, I'm like, you know what? I'll cut 2,000.
Probably we should all have those instincts, really.
Yeah. I think at the end, I think it's all about timing. I mean, I really think that you need to not rein it in for a very long time, because that's how you end up with finding these odd scenes or odd moments with characters that you just didn't anticipate. Like, I never think a story is done until it's eluded whatever my initial idea of it was, like until something else has appeared in it that I wasn't expecting. That to me feels like I've really gotten somewhere because I've surprised myself. And then at the end, you need to be absolutely ruthless, but you can hold off being ruthless for a long time.
That's true. I know, like, I really enjoyed working on the story with you because I think we were working on it last summer, obviously everyone mm-hmm. in lockdown and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I had planned to spend some of that summer in Lisbon.
Right, as had
hoping to return after going to the Disquiet Literary Conference the year before. And so I think it was as close as both of us could get to being in Lisbon, was spending time in the story.
Right. This was our Lisbon hologram for a little while. I really enjoyed the work that you did on it and allowing me to continue to exist in this space for a little longer. It did feel a little bit like, well, we can't have Lisbon this summer, but I can try to reapproach it through finding parts of this story that I'm still attached to.
Yes, and someday we will all go back.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think my favorite scene in the story is when M tries to warn the French couple that they're in danger. And their interaction is so quiet. It's almost kind of mundane. And I love how that undercuts what could be, you know, a melodramatic moment like we've seen in movies with spies and things like that. And I think, you know, we carry so much of the drama and stakes of World War II in our sort of collective memory that, it doesn't need to be bigger. It needs to be in a way kind of quieter and smaller. Okay. Could you talk about how that scene came together?
You know what? It's so interesting that you hone in on that scene. I think it's also my favorite scene in the in the story. And I think what's so strange about that is that I think that of any scene in the story, that one maybe has the fewest changes between when I originally wrote it, between first draft and final draft, of any other scene there. I mean, there's so much else that changed, that shortened, that got to, but that one in a way sort of showed up and stayed. It might have gotten a little shorter, but I think for the most part, it showed up kind of whole cloth and then just sort of remained. I mean, that happens very rarely. But I think somehow that was a sign to me that there was something in the story that was functioning pretty well, because when the conflicts are set up in the right way, then the scenes can take on this kind of menace or meaning or anticipation in the smallest details without you having to do a ton of kind of screaming about it, right? Like that it'll be there because it's just extant. It's just imminent in the interaction. So you know, actually, after seeing this French couple more or less kind of off stage the whole time, and you hear them talked about endlessly, and then here they are, they kind of show up, and we know them, and the conversation they have, it is all kind of innuendo, and it's all them sort of feeling one another out. And I mean, I wish I could say exactly why it is that particular scene showed up and then just sort of stayed in its original form, because it would make my work so much easier. it's just a very rare thing. But I think maybe that was the signal to me. You know, there's plenty of stories that I start and I start working on and I abandon, or they get stuck, or I finish a draft and I just feel like it's not really working, and then maybe it goes by the wayside for a while. But maybe that to me was actually a signal that there was something here that was operative in a way.
Yes, it's just a great moment for M's character. I think, you know, in so many other scenes, there's so much complexity. And I feel like in this one, you know, we know exactly why he's warning them, and it's nice to see, you know, I mean, he's a complicated character, and you're glad to see him in that moment. Yeah. I love that when things sort of stick around from the first draft.
Yeah, isn't that strange? Sort of, I mean, if you could say why. And it's also great to get that feedback from somebody who's reading it and says, you know what part I really loved? And you're like, that's the part that I really thought was working. Like, you really, you spend so much time living in your own head that to hear something that you more or less thought about the piece confirmed out loud by someone else feels like, oh, good, maybe I'm not insane.
You wrote a piece for the Los Angeles Review of Books a few years ago about sort of reading Lisbon through Pessoa and other books. And when I read it, I was struck by how some of the authors and translators that you mentioned in that piece are now published right alongside you in this portfolio of writing from the Lusosphere that the Common published. Is that weird? Is that wild?
It's terrifying. Yeah. my first thought was actually terrifying. I mean, you think, when you're writing these things in the privacy of your own computer and you sort of close up the laptop and you sort of walk away from it and it's all part of your imagination. That's one thing. I think, to write about Lisbon in a way in front of people who've lived their whole lives in Lisbon is all of a sudden, you know, you're responsible for a lot more. than maybe you were maybe you were imagining. And to me, that was really I was like, oh, this is real now. I mean, it's Portugal is part of my family. It's part of my family history. It's a place that I've thought about a lot, read about a lot, and always wanted to have a sort of deeper connection to than I really do in a way. Mm-hmm. And so the to be included in this portfolio alongside these writers that I've been reading now for years and really admired. I mean, Susana Marquez's book, Now and at the Hour of Our Death, is really just one of my favorites. Teo Linda Garçal's book, The City of Ulysses. There's just so much other great. I mean, and also just people that I had been in, that I had met through the LUSA workshop. Just gorgeous essays. Una Patrick's piece in there. Fatima Policarpo's essay. I mean, there's just so many beautiful works. It's a nice package. It's just something that I know I'm going to keep on my desk for a really long time. It's a terrifying experience to write about, this kind of fraught period of Portuguese history, and have it be included alongside people who lived through it. I think that if you're not actually thinking carefully about why you're telling the stories you're telling, and what are the ethical and responsible and meaningful ways to do that, then you're probably doing something wrong. So in a way, I think that the terror is at least kind of instructive, in making sure you avoid certain kinds of exploitation or sentimentality or kind of easy narratives about the historical past.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely something we tangle with at the Common, because we're obviously always looking for really placey writing. And I think mm-hmm. we tend to get a lot of travel writing,
right.
and some of that does everything right. And some of it can be, a little bit more of like the American abroad sort of exoticizing things. And,
right.
Yeah.
Right. I think, right. At least having some sense, I mean, in a way, I think being a little bit terrified and humble about it is probably a useful thing to hang on to. I think it's probably not mm-hmm. something that you want to get rid of. I think you want to be asking yourself these questions all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. That absolutely makes sense. Yeah. Your novel, Last Days in Shanghai, is about a young congressional aide on a business trip with a sleazy congressman to China. It has some amazing reviews, and I just wanted to read this quote by Jim Shepard, who is a friend of the Common. We love Jim Shepard. He said about your protagonist, he presents himself as yet another innocent abroad for the same reason most of us do, to deny our complicity in the damage that follows in our wake. And that really grabbed me, because I'm also trying to write about complicity right now, and it is so hard. Would you talk about writing that part of your novel? I mean, does that sort of relate to what we were just talking about in terms of like trying to write a place abroad and really tangle with it?
Yeah, I mean, I I'm going to put a plug in for Jim Shepard's. He has a novel coming out in May called Phase 6 that I just got the galleys of. And I'm reading now and completely enraptured by, and it's about a pandemic. And he wrote it, I think, substantially before, the pandemic that we are currently living through. I know that maybe it's not everybody's thing right at this particular moment to want to like dive into the fictionalized version of it. But Jim is so good, and he's been on the, pandemic and disaster beat, forever. So it's not out until May, but everybody should go grab, Jim Shepard's book, Phase 6, as soon as they can, because he's just one of the greatest writers we have out there working.
Absolutely.
Back to complicity. I think about it kind of endlessly. I think about it in terms of, by the time I've woken up in the morning, checked my phone, and gone to make coffee, right, I'm already complicit in this whole global system of wage theft, labor abuses, environmental degradation. Like even if you bought the good fair trade coffee beans, they somehow had to get to you with fossil fuels. They were probably put on a shelf by an unvaccinated minimum wage worker who were keeping us all afloat, right? Like, I mean, you're complicit in an inordinate number of these complicated systems, just as a fact of your kind of like daily life and routine. I mean, that's obviously a kind of a smaller example, but my own ability to just kind of keep on doing what I'm doing in a way involves giant complicity in structures that I know to be sort of abusive and unfair. Mm-hmm. I think from a narrative position, I think a complicit person is in an intriguing position. I mean, they're both in a way, the character Luke in Last Days in Shanghai, I thought about as somebody who, exactly as Jim describes it, and I think probably more eloquently than I could have, right? To me, that book was about the justifications, the rationalizations that have allowed somebody to go on doing the work they're doing and living the life they're living, in a way crumbling all at once. And then how do you piece together your psyche? And then how does that change your behavior in the wake of that, right? Or does it? I mean, in a way, like, I think there's an enormous temptation to retreat back into what you were doing, to not see the thing that you've now been shown, to sort of come up with a new set of rationalizations or justifications for it. So for Luke, it was trying to set up this drama that the novel just unfolds over the place of a week, where it was like, this is the opening for him. He's been doing this. He's been living the life he's been living for a couple of years now. This is the small window in which he's been presented with something that he in a way can't digest into his normal mm-hmm. rationalizations for his behavior. He's in a way like looking his own complicity in the face. So now what's he going to do? And the window is going to close in a way, right? Like he's either going to take some action to try to extricate himself, to try to in a way like atone for things he's done, or he's going to come up with a new set of justifications that allow him to continue on doing what he's doing. I mean, I think I'm just sort of fascinated by a character like that or character in that position, because I don't feel like it's necessarily that divorced from myself. I mean, the character of Luke is doing things, first of all, he's working for a Republican congressman. So at least, that's something that I haven't done yet and probably won't do, but in a way, I don't see myself as that distant in certain ways. And I think that there's something similar happening with M in the Vigilancia story, which is there's this moment where, as he's faced with trying to extract information from this maid who he figures out he has a deeper history with. I mean, she presents, again, a challenge to his own ideas of how he exists in the system around him. I mean, he has, in a way, his own set of rationalizations for it. And those are put to a challenge. I mean, they're put to a test. And it's just something that I think it comes up a lot in the things I write, I think, because I don't necessarily have great answers for them in my own life, and feel this need to continually explore them.
That makes sense. One thing that I've been struggling with is sort of, maybe it's just that you have to have faith in the reader to figure it out. But right. When you're presenting things like those, like justifications and rationalizations that your character might have for behavior that the average reader maybe finds pretty horrible, do you worry that readers will sort of encounter that and be put off by it? Like that they think you're justifying something on behalf of your character that you also believe, or do you just sort of have to take it on faith that they'll stick it out long enough to see that there is some change possible?
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly, having your book or your work be read as an endorsement of behaviors that you're that you're describing, mm-hmm. It's certainly a worry. I mean, I do take issue with the idea that sympathy is only for the sympathetic. Mm. That to me actually does not seem like sympathy. It's more or less, it's something else, right? So I do think it's kind of a problem. It's something that I see a lot in a lot of stories and a lot of novels, even smart, well-written, good books. They've contrived the narrative in certain ways to render the characters, extremely sympathetic, in ways that, of course, kind of like demand the reader's sympathy, because how could you feel otherwise? Mm-hmm. And I think that if you're only extending sympathy to nakedly sympathetic people, that we're actually talking about affection, not sympathy. We're talking about something completely different. I mean, it seems to me sort of the same way, you know, you need to make, when you're making peace, peace needs to be made with enemies, not with your friends, right? I mean, it's like when you're talking about peace treaties and peace talks, you're talking about disputants, and you're talking about like real insoluble problems, but that is what peace is. It's like coming to those sorts of understandings. So, I think that this is one of the things that fiction can really allow us to do, is in the privacy of our homes and privacy of imaginations, like imagine the lives of people that that we might not consider on their face sympathetic, but sort of ask why they're doing what they're doing. And in a way, like kind of be allowed to exist in that liminal space along with them. I mean, I think reading a novel, you know, I'm not usually that concerned with this kind of sympathetic, unsympathetic dialectic with a character. I'm not really thinking of a character in a novel as somebody who I want to invite over for a dinner party, or back when we still did that, or somebody that I would necessarily be friends with. I'm interested in just seeing human experience displayed. And I think I really am interested in the justifications that people make for their own behaviors. Cause I think we tend to think, I think we tend not to always see the elaborate edifice that people have constructed around their behaviors that make those behaviors to them make in coherent internal sense, even if from the outside they look horrible, right? I mean, I think a lot about, one of my favorite novels for various reasons is Patricia Highsmith's The Talented Mr. Ripley. And Ripley is obviously a monster. But as you read along with him, one of the amazing things that she's able to do is just show you the elaborate apparatus of internal justification that Ripley is able to come up with for what he's doing. And I think it's often, these are the stories that people tell themselves about, well, I'm not the worst one, or this, my behavior is not as bad as these other people's, or this is what you have to do to survive, or this is just the way the world really is. Or, I'm really interested in what happens when the story is able to put pressure on those justifications and sort of explode the story that a person has told themselves.
Yeah, I think there's definitely like a lot to be learned about ourselves as humans from reading those kinds of stories. And I think you make a good point that in our regular daily lives, we might not have the bandwidth to even like allow ourselves to think about those things and ask ourselves those questions about ourselves. So maybe the closest most of us can get without a mental breakdown is reading it in fiction and exploring it in fiction.
I think that's the beauty of the privacy of fiction in a way too. I mean, that you're able to approach it, in the privacy of your own imagination. This is not the same. I mean, it's just, I've had this conversation with friends a lot of times. Like, it's just not the same as having Humbert over for dinner. Like, I don't want him as a neighbor and I don't want to have social interactions with him, but I am fascinated at the elaborate justification and the kind of aesthetic dodges and the crazy world that he creates to justify the horror that he's enacting. I mean, that is interesting to me in a way, because it's just like, how do we explain, just the awful things that we see going on around us? I mean, I will spend time with him in a novel in a way that I never, I mean, it's not this, I just would never do that, obviously, in my normal life. There's no, I mean, that's senseless.
Yeah. And I I'm counting on the fact that people will want to spend time with unpleasant characters, and that, in a way that they would never do in person, and that does not constitute an endorsement in any way.
Yeah. I mean, that to me is one of the, yes, the idea that, that you can sort of describe or explain without endorsing. It seems to me just one of the baseline benchmark beliefs that I have about fiction and its purpose and what it's there for. And in a way, like, we get to enact these dramas in our imaginations as sort of like test cases. Mm-hmm. Without necessarily having to deal with all of the real life baggage of them, right?
Right, right, yeah.
This is what we're reading for.
Yeah, no real life harm was caused.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also why we get to indulge in the fiction that this is all imaginary or made up, you know? Mm-hmm. Then I think that's part of the, you know, that's part of the world that we've carved out for fiction, I think, is that we get to all pretend that it's that it's just imaginary for a while, so that we can think through it in ways that would be, I think, harder to do in other circumstances.
Yeah, for sure. Would you tell us what you're working on now? What's next from you?
Yes. So I've been, you know, usually I tend to write short stories as a when I get stuck or lost on my novel projects. So every year or two, I tend to write a short story as a way of just like clearing my imagination from the world that I've been working on and getting into another one. And, you know, short stories will enact a certain form of discipline on you too, especially when you're writing a novel and you think, I have all the pages and all the time in the world, and the reader's patience is going to be endless with me, right? They're just going to endlessly indulge all of my fantasies here. And a short story is like, look, you got 20 pages. You better wrap this up. So I've been at work for years now on a novel called Mexicali that's about the California-Mexico borderlands, where I grew up and where, you know, my father's family, the sort of two tributaries of my family history here, is my mom's family is all from Portugal, and around the same time they were on a boat to the United States, my father's side of the family was moving out to the border and settling in this what's now a massive agricultural region, the Imperial Valley. But then 100 years ago, there was, I mean, just very, very little there. And so the novel I'm writing, Mexicali, takes its title from the Mexican city that is just across the border from where I grew up. And it's essentially about the history of how these towns came to be on kind of either side of the border. And, you know, the period that I'm writing about, you know, takes place from roughly kind of 1910 to 1930. So you get to sort of see in the real time of the novel, all of this elaborate kind of border apparatus being built up. I mean, when my family first got there, you know, there wasn't a giant militarized border fence. There wasn't a border patrol yet. Most of the border immigration inspectors who were there were actually there to police Chinese nationals who were forbidden from coming to the United States by the Steel and Forest Chinese Exclusion Act. So if you were a Mexican national, you could still cross more or less freely into the United States without any kind of documentation. And, you know, over the course of the novel, that actually begins to change a great deal. I've had that. Some of this is drawing from certain kinds of family stories. A lot of it is a pretty deep historical dive as well. The novel, I was talking about the maximalist edit. It's in its maximalist stage right now. I just gave that the big version to my agent, and he's read it, and so now we're working on the minimalist edit. So I think the better part of this year is going to be spent in trimming it down from the gargantuan size that it has reached. And hopefully it'll be somewhat completed, at least for the next editorial process, by sometime later this year.
That sounds great. Is that a lot of research in the process?
It has been. I mean, although again, because it's this place that I grew up, obviously the landscape and this desert landscape and the agriculture and the canal works and the Colorado River and Mexicali itself. I mean, these are places that I know fairly well, mm-hmm. In a kind of landscape way. And I know the weather and I know the, I know what it feels like there on a hot summer day. And I know what it feels like when the desert is freezing cold at night. And there's a lot there that I can draw on. That's just like the physical existence of being in that place. And then when I go back and do the historical stuff, some of it is just, trying to recover a ton of history, mostly from the mostly like kind of Mexican history, that, you know, even though I grew up, steps from that border, I knew more about, the Mayflower.
Yeah.
And the Pilgrims than I did about the Mexican Revolution, right? I knew who Pancho Villa was because his portrait was on the wall of a lot of like Mexican restaurants and stuff, but it wasn't like who Pancho Villa really was.
Right.
Was something that was not exactly taught in your like California social studies or history curriculum. So some of that is just like, the shocking ignorance of being an American who can grow up essentially just right alongside another country while still having very little idea of its deeper kind of political and social history. A ton of research about the Mexican Revolution that was going on at the time, which in contrast to World War II stuff, the kind of major figures in that drama are not by and large just on the tip of the average American raised readers. Mm-hmm. Lips, so there's a fair amount of work that has to be done there in recovering that. And the history has been fascinating. I mean, the thing with research is it's also an endless form of procrastination. There's always another book you can read. And there's always another library visit that you can make before you kind of are sitting down to write. So I try to find a balance between making sure that I'm actually sitting there writing, imagining, and then also doing the historical reading alongside it, but not letting it become, not letting the research just become the project itself.
Yeah, that is a necessary step. Yeah.
Yeah.
All that sounds great. I can't wait to read the book, although I'm sure I will have to wait.
Thank you. I was going to say you can. Pre-order it probably in 2023 or something. I am deeply hoping that by the end of this year, there's an acceptable draft that is going out to various publishers.
That's great. Casey Walker, thanks so much for joining us. It's been great to talk with you. So much fun. It was a little bit like being back in Lisbon.
It was great, Emily. Thank you so much. I love this talk, and I hope that it continues down in Lisbon at the Disquiet's headquarters, Cachucha,
yes,
and the other Bairro Alto bars.
Yes, someday.
Someday.
Listeners, you can read Casey's story, Vigilancia, and subscribe to the latest issue at thecommononline.org.